Now, Cordouin uses a apologist, fairly influential apologist named Van Til, as a kind of foil for his own perspective. He does not by any means adopt Van Til's method. But he's saying that Van Til is similar to the conventionalists with respect to criteria for truth. They're internal to the worldview. Now, Van Til had an objective or correspondence view of truth, but he claimed basically that there's no epistemological common ground. You either view the universe as the result of natural forces or of God's ordering. Now, of course, Muslims view it as the result of God's ordering. They just don't believe in some pretty basic things like the deity of Christ, the Trinity, that the Bible's been preserved, and so on. So oftentimes if Van Til is arguing, he's arguing between Christians and naturalists, he's leaving out other worldviews. Now, some worldviews are non-theistic and have kind of a chance approach to life, but a strong monotheistic worldview will believe that God is transcendent and God is somehow Lord over the universe. But the idea is that there's really no epistemological common ground. So apologetics is nothing but arguing against the internal consistencies of the non-Christian worldview. So Van Til would say, if this is a Christian worldview and this is a non-Christian worldview, the Christian is trying to show that this proposition does not cohere with this proposition. Okay, and this proposition does not cohere with that one, or something like that. So the notion is that you have logical defects internally within other worldviews. And I say yay and amen. That is one part of the apologetic method. But it's not the whole method. Moreover, if we have no epistemological common ground, then how in the world can you appeal to logic, such as the law of non-contradiction? Now, Van Til was also wacky on this. He thought the law of non-contradiction was a human construct and didn't really relate to God. Once you say that, it's all over. It's all over. There's no revelation, there's no apologetics, there's no nothing. But interestingly, you know, as Cordouin points out, Van Til was not really consistent in his method. And interestingly, someone who was more consistent, Francis Schaeffer, was influenced by Van Til. Now, what you can take away from Van Til is that he emphasizes the importance of presuppositions in shaping perspectives and how presuppositions will affect the evidence you present people. So, for instance, if someone is a very strong naturalist, don't believe in the supernatural, and you give them arguments for the resurrection of Christ, they'll say, look, there is no God. There's no God to raise Jesus from the dead. You can give me all the evidence in the world. I don't believe in God. It's not going to affect me. Well, at that stage, you might want to shift ground and say, okay, let's deal with some arguments for God's existence, such as the design, cosmological, moral argument. Now, if there is such a God, that God at least could intervene supernaturally, right? Right. So you may need to push it back a step. If someone is already a theist but not a Christian, and they believe that Jesus was one of many important spiritual leaders along with Buddha and Confucius, and they don't believe in the resurrection, but they do believe in a supernatural order, then you could probably get started more quickly with them giving evidences for the resurrection. But the way Van Til viewed it was that the Christian worldview was, as it were, a package deal. You have to accept the whole thing or you don't accept any of it. That's simply just not true. Because what you need to do with unbelievers is find, I'll destroy this great art here, you have to find points of overlap. So here's your worldview. No, it isn't. Yeah, that's nihilism. Here's your worldview. And you hope it's roughly consistent with what the Bible teaches. And you have someone else's worldview. I still really like the days of chalk, which are gone forever now in our high-tech world. But someone else's worldview is going to overlap with yours, right, at some points. And these are the points you call points of contact or common ground. Now, what you want to do is, you know, so you've got the proposition one here that they don't believe, proposition two that they do believe. and proposition three that they believe, which you don't believe. Okay, see how that works? Not too complicated now. So what you're trying to do is, first of all, identify the points of common ground. And the points of common ground will be different with different people. Let's say someone is raised in the church, doesn't know the gospel, thinks if you're a good person, you'll probably go to heaven. Well, they believe in God. They believe in objective morality. They don't believe in the gospel. You've got lots and lots of common ground. Let's say you're talking to a Buddhist who believes in exactly no God and believes Buddha was enlightened. Where's your common ground with the Buddhist? You've got to use logic if you're going to communicate anything. Moreover, Buddhists are very concerned with compassion. So you could talk about the meaning and the nature of compassion and what worldview best supports compassion between people. You're going to find some point of common ground with just about everybody. And I don't mean that you both like water skiing. That's more, you know, relational common ground. And that is good and very important for relationships, no question. But I'm talking about getting down to business in terms of worldview common ground. You do have common ground. You also have points of antithesis. So what you need to try to do is identify where your worldviews overlap and where they differ, and then try to develop an argument. Now, the approach that Cordewin takes and that I take is called basically the hypothesis verification method of apologetics. And there are different ways of cashing this out. But it's not Van Til. It's not what's called presuppositionalism. There are versions of presuppositionalism. Now, the way I teach this class is not a class on comparative apologetic method. I could do that. But what I want to do is basically show you what method I think works and then run with it, as opposed to knowing all the different methods. Okay. Now, the presuppositional method says, unless you presuppose the whole Christian worldview, your worldview makes no sense at all. It's like trying to build a ladder out of water, that your presuppositions cannot account for reality, so you've got to take on all the Christian presuppositions, sort of jump ship entirely into this ship. Sort of basically switch webs. Now, what the hypothesis verification method says is, look, worldviews are claims about reality. Orderly, or at least they should be broad-based, broad-scale claims about reality. It's not just, you know, my favorite team is the Red Sox or something like that. We're talking about worldview questions. And no matter how fervently you believe that your worldview is true, the other person you're interacting with who's not a believer does not yet believe it. So you should present it to that person as a possibility, as a hypothesis. As I think it's true, I'm quite certain it's true, and here's why. I know you don't think it's true at this point, but, you know, try on these lenses. Think about this perspective on the human condition, on the origin of the universe, on the meaning of morality, on the identity of Christ. Which perspective makes the most sense, best explains reality? Now, some people say, well, that's just disingenuous because you don't believe it as a hypothesis. You've dedicated your life to it. See, hypothesis sounds too what? Scientific or tentative? But it's really just a best explanation argument. Now, I'm not tentative about it. I've committed my life to the fact that Christianity is true. But when I present it to someone who doesn't believe it, all the fervency and all the intensity I have is not going to convince them if they don't think it's true and rational. So to them, it's merely another option of the many options out there. So I present it as a claim about reality, and then you try to give the credentials for the claim. So the superior approach is hypothesis testing. A belief system is considered to be true if it proves to be superior to all other belief systems in all relevant tests. Shouldn't be rests. Tests, okay? And it's very important to find common ground between worldviews, really between individuals, because especially in our kind of grab bag, self-styled belief culture, if someone says, I'm a Buddhist, or I'm a Hindu, or I'm just a spiritual person, or even I'm a Christian, you need to ask them what they mean by that. Now, having some background in comparative religion and having a background in philosophy helps a lot. But you have to remember that person is the expert on what they do or do not believe. And it may be very bizarre in relationship to what they claim to be. It's amazing what Christians believe. It's sometimes amazing what so-called Buddhists believe. That is, what they believe is not in sync with their historical tradition and their sacred books. So you've got to figure out what they believe. They may not even know until you ask them. You'll find this out with your apologetic interviews. You'll be asking questions that people have never pondered thoroughly or reflected on. But they've got to come up with something. And what they come up with, maybe I don't know. So that's part of their worldview. They don't know about that. They're agnostic with respect to that part of their worldview. All right, questions or comments about that? Hypothesis testing. Now, we've got to get to the issue of how do you test the hypotheses? Worldviews are really hypotheses about everything. Because Christianity or Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam or atheism, and there are different types of atheism, they all have in common there's exactly no God, are macro explanations. They attempt to explain existence. That's what a worldview does. Even postmodernists that say we don't deal with meta-narratives, we only deal with local stories and local knowledge, still end up with meta-narratives when you press them a little bit. So questions or comments so far about this method? You take presuppositions very seriously, yours and theirs, but you don't demand that they just take on all of your presuppositions all at once. You try to find the points of contact, the commonality. Relationally, that's important, but also, you might say, worldviewishly. All right, well, let's go to logical criteria. Very important here. And this relates nicely to what we just did with respect to the components of knowledge. The first one you have to be very careful with, and that is relevancy or pertinence. And let me use a term from William James here. What is a live option? So it makes sense to present the Christian viewpoint as something that is attractive, that appeals to certain constants in the human condition. The need for meaning, value, significance. Those are constants in the human condition. Now, they take different forms in different cultures at different times. So when I say relevance or pertinence, I don't mean being trendy. I don't mean recasting Christianity in a way that will attract someone and then do a bait and switch technique. I mean go for deep pertinence, that this appeals to something fundamental in the human condition. So we're not accepting the pragmatic view of truth by any means. And we're not saying Christianity has to go postmodernist to reach postmodernists. In fact, in order to show the pertinence of the Christian worldview, you will likely have to do a fair amount of negative apologetics. So if you're dealing with someone who's just an out-and-out relativist, you've got to argue against relativism before they will ever take Christianity halfway seriously. So obviously, you can't make Christianity relevant by making it relative, because it's not relative. There are absolute truth claims. You with me on that? Now, your method for engagement should be culturally aware, existentially alert, prayerful, savvy, not sly, not tricky, but savvy. Wise as a serpent, innocent as a dove. Now, I attempt to do this in a lot of different ways. Sometimes I do it right, sometimes I don't. Let me just give you my most recent attempt. Whether it'll work or not, I have no idea. There's a Jewish writer for the Denver Post who recently wrote an article against Jews for Jesus. In fact, Len wrote an article about that column. And he was saying, I was born Jewish and it's important to me. And he called the Jews for Jesus people a cult and various things that I would disagree with. And I thought, well, how could you reach somebody like this? And I wrote him an email and I said, I read your column about Jews for Jesus. And I realized, and I said, I'm a Christian. I didn't pretend I wasn't a Christian. And I said, I've written a book about Jesus as a philosopher, as a person who used arguments and had a distinctive worldview. Would you be interested in looking at Jesus through that lens? I'll send you the book. So I was not being disingenuous, like I'm not really a Christian, you know, I'm faking it or hiding or something. I said, I'm a Christian, I teach at a seminary. I read your column. Would you be interested in looking at a book that looks at Jesus as a Jewish philosopher? I haven't got anything back yet. It may be one of the many times I strike out. But I try. You try to be savvy with people. You try to find some point of curiosity even. See, the common ground existentially may be curiosity in a good sense. Presenting it in a creative way that is not bait and switch, that is not dishonest. So I think in apologetics and evangelism, we should be straightforward, but we should also be shrewd. We should never be dishonest or crafty. Unless you're smuggling Bibles. That's a different issue, and that's my ethics class. But in terms of apologetics, I think you need to be straightforward, but also alert to interesting and unexplored possibilities for how to get people's attention. All right, you with me on that? Can you think of any things like that? Relevance, pertinency, or pertinence? Yes. Sinfulness? Yeah, the term sinfulness is probably not. But if you try to explain people's sense of inadequacy and frustration and guilt in Christian terms, then that is a very good point of contact. Now, if you just start out in an apologetic interaction and say, you know, all people are sinful, so you're sinful, so you need Christ. Those propositions are all true, and it's an argument. But what does sinfulness mean? And how does it show its colors in the human condition? In fact, when we get to Pascal, he was the master of doing this, reflecting on the human condition as both great and depraved at the same time in this strange, unstable combination. The Christian account of the human person is both transcending nature through being made in the image of God and also enslaved to nature through the fall and enslaved to sin through moral corruption is an ingenious kind of existentially powerful argument to give. But he doesn't start out by saying we're all sinful. He starts out by illuminating the foibles of the fallen human condition and then working his way to an explanation for it based on creation, fall, redemption categories. Mike, did you have a comment? Okay, we covered that. Okay, so relevance or pertinence, show that this is a live option. Now, with some people, you may have to work to show this is a live option because they have been so completely stupefied by popular culture that they may not be asking the right questions at all. You know, they may have possibly the whatever response, or it doesn't matter, or whatever works for you. Now, sometimes you have to do this carefully and prayerfully, but sometimes you want to say, well, you know, if this is true, then it makes all the difference in the world. Because we're talking about matters of eternity. We're talking about eternal life, or the opposite. We're talking about heaven and hell. Now, given that kind of a claim, wouldn't you at least want to look into this and not just shrug your shoulders or smirk or say whatever, or if it works for you? And we'll come back to this when we talk about Pascal's wager. There are ways of using this relevance criterion. It's called prudence. What is it prudent to believe? That is, if X is true, and X has tremendous consequences with respect to whether you believe it or not, don't you want to look into it? It's a basic prudence kind of argument. It's not, you know, it is a chance in a million it might be right, so I'll believe it just in case I don't go to hell. Just in case it's true, I don't go to hell. That's not how I'm arguing whatsoever. That is a crass caricature of Pascal. There are a lot of them out there. Believe me, I've seen them. Yes?
On your first view of eternal meaning about an afterlife being kind of moot these days in this culture, my experience is that people are so temporary and focused and so consumed with morale and capacity and mentality that they don't have any space for that. They're kind of paradigm.
Well, yes and no. Some people may be so mired in the temporal, in the today, in instant gratification, that they don't think in those terms. But I think you can even find certain elements of popular culture that address those themes, occasionally at least. Questions of the afterlife, the meaning of death. I mean, this really came to the fore after 9/11. So many people died so quickly. You know, more people died in one day than any time in American history, at least with attacks on the country. Maybe D-Day more died in one day. Yeah, I think so. But, I mean, this really brought it to the fore. But where are these people? They're all gone. Over 3,000. They're gone. That was obviously a Kairos moment to talk about destiny, eternity, matters. And, you know, great philosophical spokesmen came to the fore like Oprah Winfrey to tell us they're now all angels. So you look for those openings, right? You look for the moments. And apologetics and witness bearing should be very, very logical, very philosophical, very critical intellectually. At the same time, it involves a lot of just existential savvy and being led by the Holy Spirit. When do you say it? When do you not say it? When do you drive a truck through the opening? And when do you just sort of put your nose in there? And you learn by doing it, and you learn by making mistakes. Okay? Yes. Well, sure, you could say you have moral outrage over the 9/11 attacks. You have moral outrage over the attacks on the school children in Russia. What is the basis for the moral outrage? I mean, what does that moral outrage tell you about the universe? And most people haven't thought about that. They're just outraged. Well, why is it not merely just an emotive reaction? Like when you stub your toe, you say, ouch. What is different about moral revulsion and condemnation than other types of disapproval noises? Well, it requires a certain universe to make it obtain. It requires a universe in which there is good and evil. And there are some evils that are so atrocious and so horrendous that they deserve absolute and categorical condemnation. We're not reading it. There are a few books out there we're not reading for this class. But there's a great book. It's mixed. But there's a great book called A Rumor of Angels by Peter Berger. It was written in 1969. And he gives some very different kind of arguments for transcendence. He calls them signals of transcendence. And one of them he calls the argument from damnation. And he's trying to look for everyday common occurrences, he's a sociologist, that indicate at some level people are presupposing a world in which the sacred exists or the transcendent exists. He has five ways of doing this. One of them is called the argument from damnation. The argument from damnation is that in some situations, people will naturally condemn categorically and unconditionally certain actions as evil. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. No mitigating circumstances. No one man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter. This is wrong. And moreover, the wrongness of the act can never be fully paid for in the temporal realm. A fiery death is not good enough for those hijackers. If they just burn up and die and don't exist anymore, it's not enough. So some actions cry out to heaven for vindication. They also cry out for hell, for punishment. And see, this is a very deep moral intuition people have. When they hear that a young person has been sexually abused, when they hear innocents have been tortured and tormented and so on, people will just say, and I'll just say it now because I'm saying what people will say, they'll literally say, God damn it, and they mean it. But they don't even know they mean it. He calls it the argument from damnation. That could be a point of common ground. In fact, there was a real opening for that after 9/11, and I really jammed on it in apologetics. Even the New York Times, right after 9/11, said, acts like this call out for a transcendent moral standard. Those are the exact words. The New York Times. This is not exactly, you know, Sunday school press. The New York Times said acts like this do not fit relativism, cannot be explained in terms of postmodernism. They call out for a transcendent source of moral evaluation. And then they just dropped it. And they got over it. It's in my apologetics book. You can believe that. And I say it whenever I can. That's right. It does call out. And is there anyone there? We say, yes, there is someone there. The God who is there. The God who is totally good, who made us in His image, who made us to identify good and evil. See? Then we try to build in the worldview explanation as best we can in that setting. So the argument from damnation is a very good point of common ground with people. Yes?
How does an emotive response that continues even after, say, in the example of a murder, someone murders someone's brother, and this person is upset with the murderer, obviously. Well, the murderer repents, says, I did it, I'm sorry, and he asks God for forgiveness, but the person is still angry with them. How does that fit in?
Well, that's more of an emotional issue. See, the argument from damnation is only to do this. Establish that there are moral principles, moral properties, and there are some acts so heinous that deserve more than earth can give. That's all the argument is supposed to do. It's not supposed to help you with forgiveness. It's not supposed to help you to forgive people who have repented. That's all a different issue. It's just the basic sense of moral outrage and what worldview accounts for or explains or justifies that sense. Okay? And the argument is that puts you into theism, a personal God who can punish evil, who has given us a sense of right and wrong and so on. But it's not the whole apologetic, by no means. And it's not the whole psychology of dealing with repentant evil people either. By no means is it. And it's not an argument for a particular eschatology either. It's just a basic sense of condemnation obtaining for states of affairs. And if it's true, relativism is false. Postmodernism is false. It calls out for a transcendent justice. Now you're in the haunted world of theism. The universe is now haunted by transcendence. And what does it mean? Does that help? Okay, there's another point or comment over here, I think. Or actually, let me go back here first. And tell me your name. Daniel.
I think how this works within like a one-on-one context or like an event situation that puts together. How do you do this in the context where there's a lot of different worldviews, for example, like a church? Like the
Well, you have to be audience sensitive. You have to be audience specific as much as you can. I mean, for instance, Lord willing, November 1st, I'll be giving a talk at CCU called Are All Religions One? My basic point is to say they're not all one, and I'm using Jesus and Buddha as contraries. They can't both be right. So all religions can't be one if they can't both be right, and then I'll give a short argument for the truth and rationality of Christianity. Now, who's my audience? What is going to be relevant to these people? It's a university. So I'm hoping that they respect learning and logic. So I'm going to try to be as learned and logical as possible. I think also people want a communicator to be concerned and passionate and articulate and a good speaker. And, of course, I always try to do that. You'd be stupid not to. Now, when the questions come is when it becomes more particularized. If someone asks a question, I try to get a read on that person to figure out what exactly it is that's bothering them and what I should say in response to be, you know, true, rational, and relevant all at the same time. Now, you have to do it on the fly in that kind of a situation. If you do it interpersonally over time, then you know someone and you know them better and you can give more well-informed responses. So you try to be as audience-sensitive as possible with respect to basic pertinence. Then you particularize it in other more existentially person-to-person or one-on-one kind of settings. Because, yeah, you may have a very diverse crowd. So you've got to go for something you think will relate to all of them at the level of truth and rationality. So you notice how I build that in at the level of truth and rationality? I don't want to relate to people on the level of stupidity. And I don't want to relate to people on the level of being hip or cool or something. I want to relate to them on what matters to them and what's true and what's rational and what deeply concerns me and should, if they think about it, deeply concern them. So there's no bells, no whistles, no smoke, no mirrors, no special effects. Does that help? Okay. There was a question here. And your
Summer.
Summer. Yeah.
On the issue of you talked about the argument for discrimination and how nobody would say, you know, that terrorists, you know, should have been how do you draw that parallel between the terrorist and just the average person who says, well, I'm not as bad as that? You know, that everybody can understand how these people who crash these planes and the towers should be deemed, but you know, I'm not as bad as them. I would never do.
Yeah, well, see, again, you're trying to press the argument further than it's supposed to go. It's not that only some actions are evil, only the extremely heinous ones are evil. It's that some actions are so evil that they call out for transcendent justice. It's not an argument that everyone's sinful. That's another argument. See, so with apologetics, you've always got to see, now, what is this particular argument supposed to do? How far does it go? And then how does it fit into the overall method? Yeah, someone could say, if you want to know about evil, talk about these terrorists, but I'm not anything like them, so I'm off the hook. Well, then you have to take it to a different level and talk about other types of wrongdoing, selfishness, pettiness, greed, lust, whatever it may be, and then, you know, try to stack that up against the claims of Jesus, and you know, there's a lot to do there. Okay. Let me go to the next point, logical consistency. Two dimensions here. You want to have logical consistency within the worldview. We've talked about that. And you want to, of course, be consistent with reality. Cordovan really didn't emphasize that enough in this section. It's not enough to be internally consistent. You want your claims to match reality, and you want to have adequate evidence that your claims, in fact, do match reality. Now, here he talks about the difference between contraries and contradictions. This is pretty basic. A contrary, you can have A or B, but not both. I mentioned that earlier with Jesus and Buddha, right? I mean, it could be that Jesus' worldview is wrong and Buddha's worldview is wrong if naturalism is true. Now, Buddhism is atheistic, but it does believe in a transcendent state called nirvana. And naturalism really has no room for a transcendent state called nirvana because all we have is material states of affairs. And nirvana is not a material state of affairs, right? And, of course, Jesus' worldview is theistic. It's possible, I just mean logically possible now, that they're both wrong in their basic worldview. If, let's say, naturalism is true or if pantheism is true. So you've got to identify the difference between a contrary and a contradictory. If you're dealing with contradictories, it's either A or B, not both and not neither. So if you say this, there either is a supernatural element to reality or there isn't. All right, have I just stipulated contraries or contradictories? Contradictories, because supernatural element can include nirvana, which is non-personal, immaterial. It can include Allah, personal, immaterial, and one. It can include the Trinity, one God in three persons. See, supernatural covers so much ground, supernatural or non-supernatural, really covers the field without remainder, without leftovers. But see, contraries don't cover the field without leftovers. So when you're dealing with truth claims between religions, you've got to take this seriously. Now, a lot of this will be the question of relevance. Let's say you're dealing with someone who is a Buddhist. The real, and they're starting to get interested in Christianity. What are the two most pertinent worldviews to address there? This is a no-brainer, Buddhism and Christianity. You don't want to say, well, you know, we have to refute every other worldview before you can become a Christian. By no means. The pertinence for them is Buddhism and Christianity. So you want to say, look, Buddhism has these various problems with the nature of the self, how karma works without a self, very little historical basis for believing certain things about Buddhism given the historical evidence. You know, just go through those arguments. And Jesus presents a different worldview. That's pertinent, but strictly speaking, there could be another worldview that's true, like pantheism or naturalism. So if you say, look, I've refuted Buddhism, and I've given a strong argument for Christianity, that doesn't mean that you have completely covered the field in terms of all possible worldviews. So the way that you target your evidence has to do with what is pertinent to the situation at the time. And you've got to realize that if you've refuted one worldview, you haven't refuted every non-Christian worldview. You know, if you've refuted Buddhism or brought Buddhism into question, you haven't touched naturalism. You haven't touched Advaita Vedanta Hinduism. You haven't touched Islam. You haven't touched Confucianism. Right? So try to understand the difference between those two. So you've got to deal with logical consistency and relationship of truth claims to facts. Coherence is extremely important. Now, I'm emphasizing here coherence in a sense not mentioned by Cordouin. And that is that it's not enough to just have truth claims that don't contradict each other. That a worldview should be interrelated. It shouldn't be a grab bag of propositions. Like, you know, take these propositions. Pat Metheny is a world-class guitar player. I am 47 years old and it rained today. Well, okay, I think those propositions are all true, but they're not really a worldview because they don't relate to each other in a deep thematic way. A worldview, I think, should be enmeshed within itself. And you can see that with Christianity pretty easily. God is a personal being. He creates persons in His image and likeness who are fallen, who fall, are created and fall. And God sends a human being to take on their sin and to triumph over sin and death and judgment through His resurrection. You see how that category of personality obtains there with God, humans, redemption? See, biblically, and this is why systematic thinking, integrative thinking is so important as Christians, is that all truth is God's truth, whether it's from general revelation or special revelation. And it all fits together. Now, you don't want to force it into a mold where it doesn't fit, but you want to see how it fits together, how it coheres, and whether it explains the things that matter most. That is, that its relevance range is adequate. Does it really explain the things that are the most deeply significant things about the human condition, or does it just ignore them? If it ignores very, 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 very important issues like the reality of evil and the future of evil, then a worldview is very defective. You know, if it ignores certain human aspirations for, let's say, personal flourishing, and in fact says the person has to be extinguished, which is really the claim of Hinduism and Buddhism. We'll get to that later. The person is the problem. The person cannot be fixed. The person has to be undone to attain enlightenment. That's Buddhism and Hinduism. One might argue that that worldview doesn't account for personality. It doesn't account for our desire to not just disappear, but to thrive, to grow, to interact with our environment profitably and wisely and lovingly and so on. Okay, and the next issue is viability. We've kind of already covered that with the discussion on the nature of knowledge. But this is a negative test. If a worldview cannot be lived out consistently, there's something wrong with it. And here what you want to look for is what I call philosophical hypocrisy, not moral hypocrisy. Philosophical hypocrisy is where you say you believe something, but you can't consistently affirm it. It's not that you don't live up to your own ideals. None of us lives up to our own ideals perfectly. Moreover, not living up to your ideals is not hypocrisy. It's pretending that you do when you don't. You know that old line that hypocrisy is the compliment that vice pays to virtue. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about philosophical hypocrisy where your worldview tells you that something should not exist, but it does, and so you try to avoid it. Or if you have a worldview that says that you are perfect at all times, and if you're limited, you just think you're limited, but you're not truly limited. Well, anytime you run out of energy, or anytime you feel ignorant about something, that can't be true. I mean, Shirley MacLaine, you know, that great metaphysician of years past, she's still around. Her most recent book is about how her dog is her guru. I'm not making this up. It's called Out on a Leash. Shirley MacLaine once said, "We are all unlimited, we just don't know it." Think about that for half a second. We're all unlimited, we just don't know it. Well, then you're limited. So you can't be unlimited, because you're limited by your ignorance. It's amazing the things that people will say. So you want to look for these areas of what you might call philosophical hypocrisy. One of my friends was trying to do this with his dad. Loves his dad, respects his dad, but his dad is a hardcore atheist. Only believes there are material states, no immaterial states. So he doesn't believe in the soul, doesn't believe in God, angels, demons. And my student and his father are quite close. And the father, when he leaves, the student will often say, you know, BJ, I love you. And BJ will say, that's great, Dad, but for you, love is just the movement of matter for no purpose. You see where he's going with that? Can love, as an attitude of the soul that's objectively real, exist in a thoroughly materialist worldview when everything is reducible to material states? Matter in motion, as Marx put it. Of course, the father's not too happy with this. He has the subjective feeling of love for BJ, but BJ's saying, look, your worldview doesn't even leave any room for real love. We're just animals that evolved according to no plan, no purpose. You don't think we have a soul. So why aren't we just reactions of the universe? Why? How could you call that love? See what he's doing? Negative apologetics in the area of viability. Questions or comments on these criteria? I think they cover the waterfront pretty well, as long as you expand on them. The basic issue has to do with, is the worldview logically consistent? Does it explain what it should explain? Does it have adequate justification that the explanation obtains for reality? And is it workable in the sense that it can be consistently lived out, that it doesn't commit philosophical hypocrisy? Yes?
To what extent does our worldview have to correspond with reality in the sense that a lot of people would say, for example, my worldview of creation does not correspond with reality that is evident in fossil records or something like that? Mm-hmm. And granted, that's an extreme example, but it isn't, to me, perhaps I've made a separation between, you know, what the world believes and I believe, and is that a certain extent not what you're getting at, or is it, you know, you said it has to be consistent with outside reason.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work in this selection of, let's say, creationism versus...
Well, yeah, we've got to come back to creation, evolution, and all that, but people make different claims. A hardcore Darwinist will say the fossil record supports Darwinism. And we would say there's good reason to question that because of all the gaps, and just quote Stephen Jay Gould on that, world-renowned paleontologist. And because there are such gaps and such long periods of stasis where there's no change whatsoever, it could be that an intelligent cause creating each of those levels is a better explanation than it all happened by chance and natural necessity. So you're appealing to the same evidence, but you're giving a different interpretation of the evidence. Now, in some cases, people don't even know what the evidence is. I mean, some people on this issue have been almost brainwashed because they've been told that Darwinism won, you guys lost a long time ago, you creationists at the Scopes trial, which is not true. And you can't even do biology without believing in Darwinism. So it's not even an open question. It's been closed a long time ago, and you have to be a miserable anti-intellectual and obscurantist even raise the issue. That's simply not true. So sometimes, you know, people's approach to negative evidence is this: there isn't any because I don't want to see it. And Christians do that too. I mean, this is how Christians sometimes try to preserve their certainty. They don't want to look at other claims that oppose their worldview. So this is how they remain certain and committed, by just, you know, keep that away from me. It's not the greatest witness in a pluralistic setting, by the way. And frankly, if it's true, I want it to hold up. If the only way I can preserve belief in this worldview is to avoid all possible counter-evidence, then I'd have to lead a divided life intellectually. And I tried that for about 3 or 4 months when I first became a Christian. It was absolutely miserable. And I don't think anybody should have to do it. Okay, questions or comments about these basic criteria. Criteria for testing worldviews. And we don't engage in special pleading for our worldview. If you're going to do apologetics the way I advise you to do it, it's called living dangerously. The way not to live dangerously is fideism or conventionalism. I know it. It's true. It's how I view the world. I'll invite you to believe the same thing. but I won't deal with your arguments. I won't deal with attacks on my view. I won't attack your view. I'll simply call or preach to you. Now, in a sense, that's not living dangerously. I'd say it's living dumbly. It's living in an uninformed, reactionary kind of mode, basically. But what I'm advising is living dangerously. Now, I don't mean living dangerously as in, oh no, every morning I wake up and wonder if some philosophical journal may have refuted Christianity. I don't live like that. I've had various struggles and crises of faith along the way, and God's preserved me through them all. I still have questions, unresolved questions. I don't mean living dangerously like that. Well, maybe it's really not true. I'm not sure. I don't mean that. I just mean in the world of ideas, you're willing to give it and take it. That's what I mean by living dangerously. That wherever God places you, whether it's with your father, like BJ, or with your brother, or with an unbeliever who's been coming to church for a few months that meets you in your office, or doing campus ministry, or writing a letter to the editor, or an op-ed piece, or writing a book, or your apologetic interview, that you're willing to dish it out and take it. Using criteria that could be agreed upon by both parties. That is, we won't say this. And this often happens. Christians will say, oh, you know, the doctrine of the Trinity is completely incomprehensible. Nobody has any idea what it means. But we know it's true. And your worldview is illogical. And I don't believe it because it's illogical. Wait a minute. Not fair, right? Not consistent. It's called special pleading. I use a criterion against you, but I don't apply it to myself. That's why I call it living dangerously. Questions or comments on this? Now, if you believe in God, and you believe the Bible is true, and if you believe the Great Commission will go forth with you or without you, then you're ultimately not living dangerously. But in terms of how this will work out in arguments and relationships, you are. And one way to defend against it is just hide your gift under a bushel basket. I think I remember someone saying we shouldn't do that.